Louis Bush. I'm a behavior analyst, a registered psychotherapist, a dad, and a Bear Clan member of Nisitchuasi Cree Nation. Join me as I explore the complex intersection of the human experience with the universe inside and out. This is Little Wing Behavioral Insights. Hey everybody, I'm Louie. We've got an awesome first episode planned for you. If you like what we're up to, hit the subscribe button because we've got some really cool episodes planned for the very near future. So without further ado, here's episode one of Little Wing Behavioral Insights. Welcome everybody. Today I'm super excited to welcome an analyst who really requires no introduction, Dr. John Bailey, but I'm going to do it anyway. Dr. Bailey has been a pillar in the behavior analysis world for more than five decades. You heard that correctly, more than five decades. He's really seen the whole evolution of behavior analysis. He's mentored 63 PhD students. He's won numerous teaching awards and played a key role in the development of behavior analysis in Florida and likely around the world. Dr. Bailey's groundbreaking research has appeared in all of the leading journals or flagships in behavior analysis and have really set new directions for the field. He's now an emeritus professor and continues to teach and inspire the next generation of behavior analysts. Although retired, Dr. Bailey is probably just as busy as ever. And many of you will know Dr. Bailey as ABA's ethics guru and from many of the seminal texts that every behavior analyst has in their collection. I got a few of them here that I just pulled off my shelf. We've got the, of course, excellent 25 Essential Skills, How to Think Like a Behavior Analyst, the research methods text I think many of us started with, and then, of course, probably a number of editions of this. This is my older copy of Ethics for Behavior Analysts, a very well-loved copy. So yes, very, very excited to have you here, Dr. Bailey. Welcome, and thanks so much for giving me some of your time. I know you're a busy guy.
Sure.
So I've got some questions for you, and I'm just going to throw them at you and really interested to hear your thoughts on any of it. So if you're ready, I'll just jump right in.
Go ahead.
All right. So the first one is just with your rich background and this pivotal role that you've had in behavior analysis over five decades, you've really had the opportunity to witness firsthand the evolution of our field and how things have changed. We've navigated through changing times, and it seems like ethics has become increasingly central to our professional practice during that time. I'm interested, from your perspective, how has the understanding of the application of ethics, our understanding and study of ethics in behavior analysis evolved? And it would be really fascinating to hear about any particular challenges or key milestones that you believe have really influenced our field's ethical journey.
Well, that's a good question. There are several of these that stand out to me and that kind of constitute the I'd say the evolution of the field. And I think for starters, we need to recognize that ABA in some respects actually began with the field of autism before there was a field of autism. So this was the very early work of Mont Wolf and Don Baer and Todd Risley with an autistic child known as Dickie the Autistic Child. This was 1964. And so following that, there was not a great amount of research or practice with that population. It was considered a very, very unusual situation. Nobody ever heard of autism back in 1964. It was a term that came out of psychiatry rather than having anything to do with us. But they approached that particular child not in terms of his diagnosis, but just in terms of his behavior. And the question was, can you modify one by one the behaviors that were so disturbing to the family? So, and a lot of people think that autism began with Lovaas in the 80s, but so you have to go further back to really get to the origin story on that. So the next thing that happened that was a huge event was Ivar Lovaas's publication in 1985, I believe it was, where he published his study with about 20, I think it was maybe 19 autistic kids. And they got a lot of treatment. They claim 40 hours of treatment. I'm not sure. If you read closely that study, it's not exactly clear that that was 40 hours because of the way it was scheduled and so on. I think they just rounded off to a certain extent. But I think what they meant to say was we gave these kids a lot of treatment and it was very intensive. And that was a radical departure. It was, in a sense, it was a group study as opposed to single subject design study. And they had two standards in there. One was the kids were all diagnosed by somebody else, so they had nothing to do with that. So these were families that had a child that had a diagnosis of autism. Somehow or another, they put the word out that they were going to do this study and they were looking for them. So they came in with a diagnosis. I'll come back to that later because that's a key point about methodology. So they came in with that. They got a lot of a treatment. It was very intensive. A lot of it was not be acceptable today because it involves some aversive events and so on. But the most dramatic thing was that they claimed that about half of these kids could be placed in a first grade class and that the teacher couldn't identify who they were. So it was a huge social validity issue. There was no data on that in that study. If we were going to, you know, wind the clock back and start over, we'd say, wait a minute, we want some in-classroom data to see exactly what's going on, because it's a little hard to believe that an astute teacher wouldn't be able to say, oh, what's that kid doing back there? That's kind of odd. But anyway, so that was a big event. That caught the attention. That was pre-internet, so there really wasn't a way to communicate that information other than word of mouth or people who would read the journals. Of course, parents don't read journals and clinicians don't read those kind of journals, so that they wouldn't know about that. But now we come to the first really big milestone, and that was Catherine Maurice's book called Let Me Hear Your Voice, which was published in 1994, as I recall. And that book, she was a writer. And she wasn't, but she was a parent, but she was a writer. She had these two kids. And at the time, she had to shop around for treatment for those kids. And it's a really, if any of your listeners have not read that book, that's a must read book for anybody who's in the field of ABA, because it tells her story. And it's beautiful, like I said, beautifully written, of how she went from one professional to another trying to find treatment for these kids. And she tells about the very strange approaches these people had and how nothing worked until she heard about the Lovaas thing, contacted him. He gave her a lead on a therapist. She hired this person who did intensive therapy with her child. And the way she writes it, it was a transformation, a radical transformation to apparently normal conduct. Again, sort of like what Lovaas was talking about with the kids that he worked with back in the 80s. And then as chance would have it, she had a second child who had autism. And so that person who helped her in the beginning helped her again. And so now it was like a multiple baseline across kids within the same family. And so that's what the book is about. And many of us were hoping that there would be a follow-up book a few years later to tell us how did it all turn out. And that didn't happen, which is sort of too bad, because that would have been very powerful information to know, you know, did it stick? Can you make that behavior change really last over time? So that's 1994. Then if you move ahead, then by then, parents were aware of this thing called autism. They were started looking more carefully at their kids. They started getting diagnoses for kids. A lot of people read that book, and so there became a demand on fairly short order for lots of therapists to do this. And in the 90s, we didn't have lots of therapists. There were programs around the country that were training doctoral level PhDs in behavior analysis, and there were a few master's programs, but there was nothing that could possibly meet the demand that was coming at our field by these parents who were just pushing and pushing. You know, and I can understand why, because it's a very desperate situation. The general understanding, I think pediatricians probably describe it this way, is if your child has this diagnosis at, say, age of 3, there's a fairly small window for treatment, and you don't want to put this off. And the pediatricians were not telling them, oh, he'll grow out of this, because they apparently knew that that wasn't going to be true. So the demand was incredible. And by parents who felt like they had a right to treatment, and they understood that. We had used the term right to treatment behavior analysis, but not in this way. This was a demand for treatment. You know, this child needs treatment. He needs it now. Where do I get it? It was that kind of imperative. And the Autism Speaks organization, nonprofit organization, came about. I don't know exactly what year that was, but it would have been in probably late 90s, I'm guessing, 97, 8, somewhere around in there. Immediately, there was a huge interest in that and cash flow into that organization. And they immediately jumped on the early internet and started putting information out to people. And they became a kind of a guiding light for parents. Like, if your child is autistic with that got the ASD label, they would be told by, I guess, maybe even their pediatricians, you need to contact Autism Speaks. They will help you find treatment. Autism Speaks became a political organization in the sense that they went state by state by state, dealing with state legislatures to get bills passed to require insurance companies to fund ABA, not just to fund treatment, as in any kind of treatment, but specifically to fund ABA treatment. And so that started in about 2000, and I believe the first state to get that, I think, was Indiana in 2001. And that was quickly followed by more states and more states and more states. And at this point, my understanding is that all 50 states have a licensing law that says that insurance companies have to fund this. And the last state was Oregon in 2013. So over a little over a decade, the entire world changed for both autism and behavior analysis, because now not only was there demand, but there was money behind the demand. It's like, we have the money, you have to come up with the services. And as a field, we were not built that way. Our research never envisioned having to scale up the kind of treatment that is necessary. So at the minimum, the understanding within the field, and this is where, you know, I was sort of in the middle of all of this, because I was around for that entire period. I was in graduate school with Mott Wolf and Todd Risley and Don Baer in the 60s. And I had a very good understanding of what the potential for the field was. And that was kind of got ingrained in me as to how this field could work. And that did not match what was coming about in 2000 with this huge demand. It just wasn't. I think the people who are not in the field wouldn't understand that you wouldn't just out of nowhere provide a professional who would know how to deal with this very complex issue of a child with ASD. It's like they couldn't envision that, because in any other area, if you had a sudden need, you'd have a sudden presentation of something to relieve the need. You would, you know, if you needed medication and they didn't have it, they would run a second shift at the factory and they would make more medications. And if they needed more than that, they'd run a third one. And if they needed more than that, they'd make another factory. Well, that we weren't set up like that. We weren't set up to meet that challenge. So the next thing that happened, and remember now that 2001 is a pivotal date for people to remember, that's when the mandates started at the first date. 2010 is when the first private equity deal was conducted. And this was by a company called Great Point Partners. And I don't know if they're still around or not, because this was very, very early. And as far as I can tell, nobody put an underline under that. Nobody in behavior analysis knew about it or had any inclination of what the implications were. So, and furthermore, most behavior analysts don't take any courses in business, and they don't read business journals. They don't read the Wall Street Journal. They don't read Forbes, Fortune. They don't read any of these business magazines. There were articles about this back in that era, but nobody knew about this. And I think if they read it, it wouldn't make any sense to them. Private equity, what? I don't know what you're talking about. But what that meant was that the small businesses around the country, therapy clinics, basically, owned and run by behavior analysts, were being bought up one by one by one and put together in a collective, given a fancy name. And now you could market this as broadly. You know, it's like, we have services for clients in 14 states. We have 56 facilities, whatever it would happen to be. Those are just made up numbers, but that's the gist of what they were doing. Well, that caught on. And that is going on now at an increasing rate. And it's matured to the point that people are beginning to see what the pattern is, which is these mom and pop operations are bought up. They're given a fancy name. They do that. But then whoever owns that whole collective of 30 or 40 of these things sells it to another company. And that's where they make their money. When I'm describing this to students and to various audiences, I describe it as a way for millionaires to become billionaires because of the enormous amount of money that's involved in these sales over time. And furthermore, and I'll come back to this again, furthermore, none of those millions of dollars go into our field. They're simply sucked out of the field and gone off. The money goes off to the investors. Okay, so the response that we had to this sudden expansion, as I was describing, that came about in 2001 with the state funding, the next step after that was the BACB finally woke up and realized that there was no way that BCBA, master's level BCBAs, would be able to provide all this treatment. So they created this certification, a new certification called the RBT. That began in 2014. That was late in the game. So see, there's more than a decade after the insurance mandate. And I think if we had been more astute, and I'm not blaming the BACB, but because they're not business people either, if we'd been more astute, I think we would have looked at that and said, you know, we need to gear up for this. We need to accelerate our training. We need to really do this. That didn't happen. So the big response was RBT certification 2014. And I think, unfortunately, and this is where I am critical of the BACB, they picked a number that I think is impractical. And the number is 40. So they said that these RBTs have to have 40 hours of training. Well, that if you look at the complexities involved in doing treatment with an ASD child, it would be a challenge for somebody with 2 years of training, let alone 40 hours. I mean, that's basically a week.
I think about when I started in autism, and after 40 hours, I was still totally in the dark.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, and I don't think it's too late. I mean, ASD is not going away. I don't think it's too late for them to double that and say that there has to be more training. We have to be, you know, more responsible. I'm not sure why that hasn't happened. So where we are today is the demand still exceeds the supply, especially if you consider the supply to be effective treatment delivered by a person who's well-trained. I'd say the supply is simply not there of therapists to do this. And at the same time, private equity is gobbling up all of these smaller agencies. And what they're doing, and this is something that the consumer, the caregivers, the stakeholders, and so on, have no idea how this works until they're victimized by it. They buy these up, and they don't make things better. They make things worse. And it's because of their what they call squeezing out the inefficiencies is their general model. So the way they do that is through scheduling and increased caseloads, reduced training, and you can save a lot of money. And if you do that, it makes your company look more profitable, which means you can now sell it to somebody else and so on. And so I think we're in a bad time right now, because we are essentially up against people that have millions of dollars and stand to make a profit, whereas we're just in it to try to help people. You know, we're trying to take, people say, what is this about? And I say, there is this thing called the science of behavior, and you can use that science to improve people's lives. That's all we're about. Notice I didn't say anywhere in that short sentence anything about, and you can get rich doing this. It's not about that. So there's a value system connected with our science that, you know, I don't know that we talk that up enough. But what I do when I'm talking to my students, especially when they're getting ready to graduate to your master's program, you're going to have to choose someplace to work. And nowadays, there are companies that are going to offer you a six-figure salary to start with. And I tell them, be very skeptical of that. You know yourself that you don't have the kind of experience that would be six figures. That'd be more than what your parents make after 30 years of work or something.
My very first class in behavioral science up in here in Toronto, George Brown College, a professor of mine, Dr. Andrew McNamara, who's just such an awesome behavioral analyst, I think it was within the first hour of the first class, he said, if you're in this field to make money, you're in the wrong field. And that has always kind of stuck with me. And so when I hear what you're saying, and when I see this rapid growth of private equity and just the expansion of these kind of fast food chain treatment providers, it really makes me worry. And it makes me think that a lot of the criticisms that we're hearing, you know, probably have truth and will probably have more and more truth as this kind of system, financially driven system, takes more and more hold of the science. Yep,
I think so. Well, anyway, that was a good question. I'm sorry the answer was so long, but I think it's a complex story.
No, it was a fabulous answer, and I really appreciate kind of seeing the evolution of it. And, you know, one of the things that I really appreciated you commenting on is that, you know, behavior analysis started, you know, somewhere kind of much different than where, you know, the general public sees it. Like almost every article you'll see online, you'll see ABA therapy, or, you know, ABA is an autism therapy. And, you know, Dickey's Glasses, that article, I remember reading that and just thinking that was so cool, of getting, you know, this young boy refusing to wear glasses and engaging in all kinds of aggression. And then just the kind of simple reinforcement and shaping procedures that got the glasses on, and the, you know, just see a completely change in that whole family's life. And before that, you had the Ion and Azrin, and actually in Canada, the psychiatric nurse's behavior engineer.
Yes.
You know, and they were working with folks on the back wards with, you know, probably schizophrenia, probably autistic adults that just weren't diagnosed there.
Yep.
And so I often think about the context. A lot of my work in dual diagnosis with adults with developmental disabilities, I started running into a lot of the folks who were in like the old regional centers, like the big institutions. And, you know, they had been in there for 50, 60 years at some point, and just engaging in these really challenging behaviors for decades, you know, and just, it was just custodial. And then obviously when the deinstitutionalization movement began, they started getting put into homes. And then, of course, you know, they wanted behavioral analysts to come help deal with these problems that had just been, you know, managed so poorly. Yeah. And I think that's a part that a lot of people aren't aware of, is that behavioral analysts had a really big part in humanizing those individuals and communicating to the public that they could learn, and that they could, you know, contribute to society, and that they, you know, had rights and things like that. And often that part kind of gets buried under the autism story.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
So you touched on this a bit already, but the, you know, the New Yorker recently published this article, The Argument Over a Longstanding Autism Intervention, and it kind of goes back and forth about a lot of the issues that have been coming up around a controversy surrounding ABA treatments in autism, you know, and it provided some balance, you know, talked to parents who their children had really benefited, and there were safety concerns and things like that that had been addressed. And then there was individuals who felt that they'd been really mistreated. And then, you know, even quarters really suggesting, it, you know, ABA be completely, you know, banished or banned. And obviously this is, I think, a conversation that isn't going away, I think, anytime soon. And it's something that our field needs to talk about and is, I think, finally starting to talk about. My opinion was, when it first came, the general feeling was, well, let's just kind of ignore this, or it's a small kind of group. But now we're seeing, you know, lots of people speaking about this. And I'm wondering, just again, from your perspective and from this ethical perspective, what you see kind of the future of ABA looking like. Are there approaches in behavior analysis that are emerging, or developments in the science that might help us address some of these criticisms while maintaining, you know, the core principles of behavior analysis?
Well, as you kind of alluded to, and I alluded to earlier myself, about the issue of RBTs and how they're not highly trained and so on, what goes hand in hand with somebody who's not highly trained is whether or not they're carefully supervised. And so, and especially through the hotline, I hear the hotline was originally for BCBAs, but over time it's gotten open. It's open to everybody. So we have parents who will complain literally about their RBT and the fact that they don't appear to be competent, and the supervisor doesn't either respond to their complaints about it or is never there. And so they don't see any supervision, and they're sort of afraid to push it too hard because they know that they were on a wait list for 6 months to get any kind of treatment. Now they've got some treatment, and I think they're worried that if they complain, they're going to be dumped and they'll have to get on another wait list, which could be even longer. So, but more directly to answer your question is, I think we probably have some malpractice out there. People, I mean, in the medical field, we've talked about malpractice for years. And it's, that term hasn't been really used in our field, but I think that it can definitely happen directly at the hands of the person who's working with the child who is not well supervised. And that raises a question about supervision. And I think that there's been a misunderstanding of how much supervision is required to take somebody who is green at this and turn them into an effective therapist. And in the guidelines from the BACB, the requirement is 5%. Well, that doesn't begin to touch what's necessary to do effective shaping on a brand new RBT given a tough child, a child that has many serious behaviors. 5%. And they should have put in all caps, minimum. And then they should have put in parentheses, this will vary from 100% down to 5%, depending upon the severity of the case and the expertise or lack of expertise of the RBT. Because my view of it is that if you had really good supervisors working closely with their RBTs, you wouldn't have the kind of abuses that people are reporting. That just wouldn't be possible. But the other way to look at this thing, and I've told my students this, and I've spoken at audiences about this, if you look at that requirement and you say, well, this is the minimum, everybody looks at the minimum, and some people say, well, what about 4%? Could I get by with 4%? That's stupid. That's just plain stupid. But if you look at that number, you have to look at the other side of it, and you have to say 95% of the time this person is totally unsupervised. That is crazy, given the importance of helping this young child get through some real, really, really tough experiences. And so I don't know where they came up with that number. I don't know why supervisors don't take it on themselves to say 5% is the minimum, but in this case, I need to put 25% or 30% or something. I don't know what's going on there. Well, I have an inkling about it, but I don't have any data on it. But I think that could be at the heart of the matter, is that we need to, as the British say, pull up our socks and get back to work here. Improve the quality. And that's my latest gripe, I guess, or rant about the field, is the issue of quality. We're not focusing on the quality of treatment. We're focusing on the amount. This child has 10 hours, he needs 20. Or he has 20 and he needs 30. It's like, no, you're looking at the wrong dimension. He needs higher quality treatment is what he needs. And as a field, I think we are burdened by the billable hour and the idea that, you know, more hours means better treatment, which is not the case. And you've got unethical conduct on the part of these private equity companies that will say they buy up the company, they start taking a really close look at the clientele that they have in there, and they see some kids with 10 hours a week, some kids with 20 or something, and they'll say, you can inform the families that if they don't increase their number of hours to at least 20, we're going to drop them. Well, the number that they have of hours is established by the physician, the insurance company, and the behavior analyst coming at some number that they think is appropriate. And so that is grossly inappropriate to say you need more hours, because the company, the privately held, private equity held company, is only interested in the money. And if they can take everybody and go from 10 to 20, they've increased their revenue on a per year basis by, you know, 1.5 million or something, probably. It depends on some other numbers, but it's huge. Some companies are saying, we routinely want kids that are 40 hours. We're going to dump everybody who doesn't have 40 hours. That is just outrageous, just outrageous. Mm-hmm. And again, as a field, we're not organized to teach, certainly master's level BCBAs, about this and how to fight it. They don't even discuss it. I gave a invited address at State Association here last month where I brought this up. And when I got to that particular point about, you know, this is, you know, we need to be better educated about what's happening to our field and so on, I had a huge clap of hands in the audience about, yes, that's right, we need to know more about this.
Yeah. Well, even as you say it now, a couple of things you said there, I just, you know, I could feel just such a surge of appreciation for you calling it out like that. You know, it's in one of your texts here, but, and I can't remember exactly where, but you had made a recommendation around a consulting behavior analyst, you know, a BCBA or BCBAD, probably having a caseload that, you know, where you could ethically function around the number 8. And that always really stuck with me. And I always advocated, you know, when whoever I was working for, when the hospital was pushing for us to take 20 or 30, you know, I would break it out and say 8, you know, and really push back. And we're seeing, you know, some of these analysts that just are taking on these incredibly massive caseloads where they might be, you know, in charge of supervising groups of 50, 60, 100 RBTs, you know, in various clinics. You know, I've heard of analysts, you know, overseeing something like 14 clinics. And, you know, I'm like, is there multiple clones of you? Because there's no way you're providing ethical service that way. And to me, it always comes down to, that's a very lucrative way to run business and probably not good for the kids or for the families.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's horrible. It's horrible.
Well, so we've already kind of started talking about my next question, but I'll ask it anyway. Maybe there's more there. So there's this very obvious growing concern about the rising influence, and I would say the rising power of private equity in the field of behavior analysis. Private equity acquisitions have become really widespread in the U.S. You know, in a recent document, they said that the majority of the privately owned behavior analytic clinics for autism in the U.S. are now private equity owned clinics. And those private equity firms have something in excess of $1.8 trillion at their disposal, which is just, you know, an unimaginable amount of power, you know, in finances. You know, we have universal healthcare in here in Canada, which isn't perfect. It's got like lots of flaws, but for a long time, I, you know, had the impression that, you know, our approach to healthcare kind of shielded us from a lot of this stuff, but I was very incorrect about that. And we are now seeing private equity firms courting Canadian service providers, and we're seeing the same kind of movement of buyouts and, you know, and then the clinical structures being formed by a board of business persons rather than by behavior analysts. And I'm really interested. You've described a bit how you think it's impacted the field. If things keep going this way, what do you see the field looking like in the future?
Well, you know, we're not the first target of private equity. Prior to us, they have picked off other areas. There's it's referred to as an industry that called the troubled teen industry that was bought up by private equity, and nursing homes bought up by private equity, and now autism. And so they can move around and destroy the quality in their wake, but there's always more money to be made. That's kind of what their philosophy is. And my vision of this is, because of the way they get grouped and sold, is that ultimately, instead of having about, I'm going to estimate this thing about 40 to 50 companies are currently in the mix. And then the way they buy and sell each other, I think it'll end up being like the automotive industry, where you have the big three. It's going to be terrible. I mean, they will have ruined it. And the one bright spot is that I got an email from a colleague yesterday. There's a group of physicians, because they're taking up medical practice in hospitals. And the quality drops whenever they do that. They sell off the property, they lease it back to people, everybody gets screwed. But there's a movement among physicians who don't want to work under a private equity owned company, and they're starting to push back. And I can send you that also, just for your own information about this.
Oh, that's great. I would love to see something similar in behavior analysis. Exactly.
We need something similar where, and what I've been telling my students and what I've been telling audiences is, you know, if you're looking for a job, one question you want to ask during the interview is, so is this company private equity owned? And if they say yes, just ask them, where's the exit? You know, just leave the interview. You have no reason to stay there, because you are about to be bought up and probably bought and sold by this company. And you don't have to do that. There are enough mom and pops out there that are desperately looking for people that can't put up the splashy, expensive internet ads that some of these other companies do, but there are ethical people out there that you could work for. And so that's you know, a sort of a grassroots approach to this. These physicians, this article I'll send you, the physicians are arguing for changes in the law to close some loopholes, because as it turns out, these private equity companies have figured out how to avoid certain kinds of taxes because of the way they've done this. So it's not only they're making millions, but they're making even more millions by not having to pay tax on certain things that they're doing. So
yes, a concerning trend that we're seeing here in Canada and in Ontario recently is the opening of private health clinics. And one surprising outcome, because the argument has been, you know, if you have private health clinics, then that will save taxpayers lots of money, because people can just go and pay for their procedures there. But what that we've actually seen in the last few years with this kind of experiment with private health clinics, where you can get various surgeries in that, is that not only are citizens paying for those procedures out of pocket, but the government is actually paying those companies more per procedure than they are paying the publicly funded hospital. So we're still spending more public dollars giving these private firms money, and you're also paying them. So the experiment, and I don't even know how that happens or, you know, what's going on there, but very concerned about the role of money in healthcare and science. And the find the exit statement from you is a powerful one, and I hope people heed that.
Yeah.
So there are behavior analysts involved in a lot of this stuff, and so I want to ask you a bit about this. So I'm interested in discussing the role of behavior analysts in owning and managing organizations. There's been this emergence of new advocacy organizations, new accreditation organizations, new certification, new training, new lobbying groups that are run by behavior analysts, right? There are behavior analysts on their boards of directors or behavior analyst CEOs, et cetera. And a noticeable observation is that some of these entities have opted not to disclose their identities. So although they are operating at a point where maybe they're interacting with government or they're advocating or they're putting out public statements, that we're really not sure who they are. And I know this is something similar in private equity, where you don't always know who those investors are. So I'm curious about your thoughts on this from an ethics and behavior analysis perspective. What are the implications of this kind of anonymous organization that we're seeing? And what are best practices, in your opinion?
Well, if there were behavior analysts involved, and they are attempting to hide their identity, that's a violation of the most basic code of all, 1.01, truthfulness. So they're not being truthful about their position on the board or on the committee or whatever it is. And I think it'd be hard to report it because you don't know who they are. So somebody has to get inside the organization, find out who people are and expose that, and then proceed to see if you can apply the ethics code to them if they are in fact BCBAs. I don't know that that has happened in the U.S., but I have heard about this in Canada. It's a very disturbing development, you know, to think somebody is possibly doing something nefarious and has figured out a way to do so behind a dark cloth. I mean, that is not acceptable. That's certainly not acceptable.
Yeah, it almost, you know, it almost seems surreal, like a secret society kind of thing. And you know, I also worry about similar things in, like you said, with boards of directors run by, you know, private equity investors. You know, when the parents showing up to the center to bring their child for treatment, they may not have no idea who's actually running the show. You know, they may meet a clinician, but that clinician may have very little power in making decisions that could really impact the life of their child.
Right. Most of these companies, one of the first things they do is they create regions out of this. Let's say they have 40 of these mom and pops under their wing, and they create regions. And so the person actually running this one that the mom walks into is controlled by somebody in, you know, another state that you never would see in person. And you probably can't even get them on the phone or in Zoom call. So it's tough. It's really tough. In fact, in some of these cases, the supervisor is remote. So the staff, the RBT staff, never really see in person their supervisor because, again, they're somewhere else and they get away with that.
That's terrible. You know, I love behavior analysis since day one. You know, when I walked into my basic principles or foundational principles class, you know, I had this feeling like I've always been a behavior analyst. I just didn't know what it was called. And now this is it, you know, but I don't like what I'm seeing in the field. And it's causing me a bit of an existential crisis, if I'm being honest, is kind of seeing how things are rolling out. But I know that we have something really powerful, and I've seen it really change people's lives. You know, I worked in locked forensic inpatient units and locked inpatient units with folks with extremely severe behavior. And you see the power of the science in really saving people and preventing severe harm and getting them back into the community and back home. And so I'm not really willing to give up on it either. And I'm glad that there's folks like you out there that are, you know, presenting and talking and bringing these things forward, because I think a lot of people are scared to say these things because, you know, there's a lot of powerful people that, you know, get mad at you about it. So, you know, it's kind of a speaking truth to power, and I appreciate that you're taking leadership there, and I wouldn't expect any less, obviously.
Well, I'm in a unique position because now, especially because I don't have an employer, so nobody can go to my employer. I can't be fired. So yeah, I guess it could be other things could happen, but at least I feel like I'm free to speak and to speak on behalf of people who maybe can't because of their position in a company. Is it, well, you know, because a lot of the people who write into the hotline, when I analyze their case, write back and say, yes, this is a reportable violation and here's what you can do. And they'll say, can I remain anonymous? And the answer is no. And, you know, you have to put your name on the notice, and they'll say, well, I don't know if I want to do that because this person is known to engage in recrimination against people. And so I don't know if I want to lose my job. You know, I have a family, I've got a house, I've got a mortgage to pay.
Those are real concerns, right? If there's a potential for retaliation and it means your livelihood, that's a tough spot to be in. And, you know, I might be in a similarly unique position, not working, you know, within the autism industry. You know, I've done a lot of work in forensic mental health. So, you know, I don't have that same kind of vested interest So I'm able to, you know, meet with you and also say this stuff from a place of probably privilege and comfort, you know, without those direct threats. But I feel for a lot of my colleagues that are in those positions where they can't speak up, they can't argue against these more powerful individuals that, you know, are holding the purse strings and really, you know, can do a lot of damage to someone's career if they want to.
Yeah.
Okay, so I got another question for you. I really appreciate all the time you've given me already. I want to talk a bit about licensure, or how we refer to it in Canada's public regulation. So it's been about 30 years of really hard-fought advocacy work by groups like the Ontario Association for Behavior Analysis, ONTABA, and also parent groups have played a pivotal role. Like the Ontario Autism Coalition is probably the biggest and most active group of parents that are just constantly, you know, raising hell for the government. Anytime they make a decision that negatively impacts their families, they'll hear about it, you know. And so they've really contributed to movement in the field in Ontario in a big way. And I know that something similar happened in the States to move a lot of these policies along. So after 30 years of, you know, meeting with policymakers and writing letters and doing all kinds of stuff, they finally have agreed to regulate behavior analysts in this province. So as of July 1st, 2024, there will be a college, a regulated health college that we will join, and we'll join the ranks of nurses and physicians and psychologists and psychotherapists. You know, I've been in lots of meetings where people have said things like, well, as a regulated health professional, you know, I think I know what's best. And, you know, to be around us, you just kind of got to take your lumps because you're not a regulated health professional. And I think that puts us at a disadvantage in many environments. So we're really excited about this, but we're also a bit nervous, you know, comes with many questions and challenges for behavior analysts. You know, we've been, you know, in a non-licensure environment for many decades, and people have gotten used to this, you know, kind of unregulated system. And I've heard a number of objections. There's a group of folks that are fairly opposed or unhappy with how regulation is occurring. I've heard things like, you know, it's going to be really expensive. Regulation will negatively impact service capacity. You know, the amount of clients I might be able to get will be impacted by this, or it'll limit the jurisdictions that I could kind of freely move in and out of, because if Ontario has, you know, regulation requirements, then I can't just go to another, you know, another state or province and just start practicing there. And so on the eve of this really huge change for our field, behavior analysts are feeling understandably a bit stressed, apprehensive, excited. And I'm hoping, because you have, you know, had so much impact in the field and particularly in ethics and standards of practice, if you could just remind us why we fought for this and what is the purpose of professional regulation?
Well, the short answer is that it's to protect the public against practitioners who are not prepared to treat them ethically, effectively, using evidence-based treatment and so on. That's the short version of what this is all about. It's not directly intended to change what the practitioners do. It's to protect the consumer from people who are not well prepared and are not regulated, not unlicensed. So and I think people who are licensed or regulated, they need to remind themselves that that's what the purpose of it is, and remind the consumer base that that's the case. So, you know, the way our regulations work is you have a certification through the board, which you can be certified in any state. You can move around whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. And then you have licensing, and licensing is on a per state basis. And so if you're licensed in Florida, but you want to move to Georgia, you're going to have to get licensed in Georgia is what it amounts to. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, the states have all agreed to some fairly basic guidelines. And so it's not going to change your practice that much to move from one state to another. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about Canada to know how that's going to work, but it doesn't change that much. But it should make the regulated licensed person feel good to know that there aren't unlicensed people out there ruining their image, calling themselves behavior analysts when they're not, and having horrible effects with the population in your name. I mean, that's the way it should be. But I would be surprised. I don't know how the regulation is written, but I don't think that, for example, we're not licensed here in Florida, but the states that are, I don't think that they have anything in their licensing code about the number of clients that you can take. They may have some statement about the kind of clients you can take. So it very much depends on how that law is written. As to what any actual restrictions are going to be.
Yeah, and they modeled our college's criteria and everything off the BCBA level. They have chosen not to regulate the BCABA level or the RBT level just at this time. There has been some discussion about the possibility of maybe a bachelor's level, but I don't see a lot of interest in the in the RBT thing, and I know that it's been a bit of a mess in a number of the states. I think the concern that is valid for lots of people in Canada, or at least in Ontario, is that at some point you won't really need to have
a BCBA.
You could be regulated because in the law it doesn't say you have to be a
BCBA.
And that is because of a number of probably legal reasons around different language acts and things like that in Canada. You got to have everything in French. And, there's a couple things that may have contributed to that. I'm not, totally clear on all of it. But basically, you got to have all the same training. So it may be that if everything kind of progresses the way it is, that, 10 years from now, there are people who go through the schooling, become a regulated Ontario behavior analyst to have the same kind of training, supervision hours, et cetera, as a
BCBA.
But they have opted not to get the BACB certification. So if they wanted to move to, Nevada or Hawaii or whatever, and that would obviously be a disadvantage for people and mobility. So I can see that concern. And I imagine that there's going to be work done on that because, like the College of Psychology has something very similar where they have an agreement in North America around the jurisprudence and ethics that is fairly transferable. You still have to, apply for visas. You still have to, register with that specific licensure body. It's not easy by any stretch of the imagination to move jurisdictions, but there is some policies built into the college bylaws and that encourage, mobility. And that is a concern that a few behavior analysts have here that I think is valid in some way and that I'm hoping that the college will work on. But the thing that I often think is, we've been pushing for 30 years for even just the ability for us to be able to call ourselves a behavior analyst and to say to somebody else, you're not a behavior analyst, and there are lots of examples of that happening here in Ontario. There's been news articles of really bad stuff going down where this behavior analyst with no behavior analytic training, was engaged in some, pretty horrific things that, got the police involved even. And then people read the paper and it says, this behavior analyst did this. And we're, everyone's doing, doing the face palming and saying they're not a behavior analyst, but, what recourse does the public have? The other piece that I guess I wonder about is even just the teeth that a college or a licensure body has versus a certification body. And I'm not singling out any certification body. There's a number of different certifications that are out there now, international, and but I think there's probably three or four that are becoming more active. But my experience has been you can make some complaints to various certification bodies, and usually there isn't a very serious consequence that happens. Like there's maybe remediation or people are told to stop doing that or whatever, but I don't see a lot of board certified people losing their certifications. I think it's quite rare, even in the face of some fairly egregious stuff. Now, on the other hand, I've seen a lot of regulated health professionals lose their licenses. And so I just wonder, between a certification body and a licensure or a regulation body, there's kind of differences, I guess, in what how they can respond or how they will respond.
Yeah. Well, licensing is different in that regard. For one thing, licensing means that there's a licensing board, and a licensing board means that you have representatives of the field on the board that are making these decisions. And it also means that there is a budget attached to that, and the budget includes money for investigators. So if somebody is reported to the licensing board and they look at it, and these are, again, these are not bureaucrats, these are representatives of the field, however they happen to be elected, but, and they can say, this is a serious matter, and they can put, you know, investigators on this, and they do what the FBI does. They go knocking on doors and they do formal interviews, and people lose their license. But, and that's fairly stringent. And right now the BACB reserves that because they don't have that investigative power, really. They reserve that to the most egregious cases where somebody has actually been arrested and detained and fined and, you know, maybe in jail time or whatever, then you're going to lose your license. But if, you know, if you do some other sport of misrepresentation or loose assessments or whatever it is, that's going to be a slap on the wrist relative to licensing.
Mm-hmm. All right. So maybe just this final wrap-up question really quickly. Reflecting on your own contributions to the field and all these changes you've witnessed, is there something that you're most proud of? And is there anything that you might do differently in hindsight?
I'm probably most proud of the PhDs I produced. They have made a significant difference in the lives of hundreds, maybe thousands of people over the years. If you train a PhD, it's a long time. I mean, it's 4 or 5 years of training, but then they work in the profession for 30 years or 40 years or something. And so I think I'm probably proud of those people. They've gone into university teaching and research, and they've gone into practice and created organizations. And you know, so I'm very, very proud of that. I'd say that's probably my most significant contribution to the field. And I did that as I had this aha moment when I was about an associate professor, about 5 years in. We were sitting around the table, faculty, and discussing admissions that we were going to, how many students are we going to take this year? And I remember as we went around my faculty group, and some of the faculty would say, well, I don't think I'm going to take a student this year. I've got one and he hasn't graduated yet. When he graduates, maybe I'll take another one. And they go to somebody else and they'll say, well, I've got a grant. I'll take two. And say they go around. And I realized that they really weren't in the business of training students. They were interested in research and grants, and that was it. And I realized that my look at behavior analysis was, we need manpower. We need people who got some high-level training who can make a difference. And so I very quickly adopted a different mantra with regard to that. And I'd say, they would come around to me and they'd say, well, John, how many are you going to take? I'll say 5. And they went, well, really? Where are you going to get the funding? Well, I've got the funding. It's not a problem. And I've got the time because I don't do anything else but this. And I built up my lab so that I always had about 10 doctoral students. And if one of them graduated, I'd take somebody else. If two graduated, I'd take two more. And so I did that for nearly 40 years. And I felt like that was the right thing to do. I knew how to teach them. I knew how to train them in research. I knew how to give them practical experience that would make a difference. And so I'd say I'm proud of that.
Awesome. Well, you've certainly left a legacy that will have an ongoing impact on the field in a really positive way. And I really appreciate all that you've contributed, and I appreciate that you've given me so much of your time. And thanks for talking to me, and I hope we get a chance to chat again. But Dr. Bailey, thank you so much for meeting with me today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to Little Wing Behavioral Insights. Check us out on social media, subscribe, and keep an eye out for our next episode.